The long column of figures tells the story. In the 20th century, before there was a vaccine, cases of pertussis, whooping cough, ran up to the hundreds of thousands per year in the United States. Post-vaccine, the numbers dwindled steadily. By the mid-70s, they bottomed out at barely over 1,000. 1,000. But in recent years, pertussis has rebounded, with cases getting up into five figures again. What changed? Vaccine exemptions, for one thing. That's what a recent study of existing data turned up in tracking where vaccine exemptions and increased pertussis cases show up together. Three authors of the study, including Barry Bloom, who's an immunologist at Harvard University, where he is the Joan L. and Julius Jacobson Research Professor of Public Health. Dr. Bloom, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
You've been in immunology for a long time. Can you just give us your own take on the way in which the disease pertussis has come back from near eradication?
Well, we were puzzled by why this disease, which, as you said, almost every kid got and caused an awful lot of illness and deaths, why we had the most number of cases in, let's say, 2012 since 1955, even though we have a vaccine. And the question then is why it came back and where it came back. And I think we did the first study with data available from states that the number of cases above the average occurred in 19 states, but only a portion of those states had good enough data to tell us where the cases occurred. And so using pretty sophisticated statistics, a wonderful student analyzed where the cases were in the states in the U.S. by county, because outbreaks and epidemics don't occur in a general way. They occur in a specific place and infect a specific group of people and can get out of hand. And the data were very clear. There was about almost a threefold increase in cases of whooping cough in those counties in states that had personal and religious exemptions.
So in other words, the non-medical exemptions where people are getting...
Non-medical exemptions where we know there are certain vaccines with kids with certain problems that they can't take them. But for healthy kids, there's really no obvious reason why they shouldn't, if we want to get community immunity, or what used to be called herd immunity. You have to vaccinate a whole lot of kids to be sure that everybody is protected against a major outbreak.
The I should point out that the title of the paper is called Geospatial Analysis of Non-Medical Vaccine Exemptions and Pertussis Outbreaks in the United States. Again, Barry Bloom, one of the three authors. Geospatial just meaning where in on the face of the earth they occur?
Yeah, we wanted to locate them both in counties, which are places, and ask the question, how many of those counties that had above average whooping cough cases also had exemptions? And that's what we found, that many of them did. In fact, the risks for kids were almost three times greater in counties that had those exemptions. What's striking to me is that when you look at, for example, Oregon and parts of Washington, there are lots of counties also with exemptions that were lucky enough not to have outbreaks of any of these diseases. So I think the study revealed there are a lot more counties at risk for outbreaks than actually occurred, and that's a matter of pretty good luck.
Just luck, you think?
Yeah, I think so. Or not having visitors come in with infectious diseases that hadn't been vaccinated.
So let's talk about the term you mentioned. I mean, we're calling it community immunity now, where once we called it herd immunity. Can you kind of roll out the basic concepts there?
So the basic concept actually came with polio vaccination in Russia. The thought was you had to vaccinate everybody in the world to prevent polio. And when the Russians vaccinated up to about two-thirds of the kids, lo and behold, the outbreaks stopped, even though one-third of the people had not been vaccinated. So depending on how communicable the disease is, how fast it transmits, You don't have to get 100%, but for the diseases we vaccinate in the U.S., most of them, you have to get over 90%. And in the U.S., we have been very efficient at getting over 90% for most vaccines.
Dr. Barry Bloom is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an immunologist at Harvard University and one of the three authors of a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or PNAS, as it's often called, about the places where vaccine exemptions, non-medical exemptions, and pertussis cases seem to cluster. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. When we get into talking about vaccines, though, I do remember talking to other people in the past about the fact that you want to have greater levels of vaccination. And in other words, there's some variation from disease to disease. Where does pertussis fall on that scale?
Probably the most communicable of all the diseases, the one we worry most about, is measles. And I would say pertussis comes in close to number two after measles and German measles. So it's very communicable. We had, as you said, on the order of 150 to 250,000 cases each year, with about 9,000 deaths each year that are largely preventable by pertussis vaccine.
And I'm shocked at the numbers myself. I went looking independently from your report to the CDC numbers, and we actually got down to 1,010 in 1976. You mentioned the 2012 numbers, which got up to 48,270. That's almost five times.
That's exactly right. So the question is why, which is why we did this study. And one possibility is since the year 2000, there has been a big increase in personal and religious exemptions, where people could just sign a piece of paper in many states and not have to vaccinate their kids. The second is the vaccine changed in the late 1990s. It used to be a whole bug, killed bug, that provided quite good immunity and dropped whooping cough to, as you said, 1,000 cases a year. The problem was it was quite a strong vaccine that caused rather bad reactions in little kids. Let me just say that those of us that worry about vaccines, they're unique in medicine because most drugs and most treatments are given to people who are sick. Vaccines are given to absolutely healthy kids very early in life, so they have to be extremely safe, and we have to be awfully sure that they're as safe as they can be. So in this case, while the vaccine was safe, kids got fevers, kids cried for days and days, and discouraged moms from getting their kids further vaccines with other vaccines. And so a subunit vaccine, just proteins, not the whole bacterium, came into practice, and that's the vaccine we now have. And one of the questions we asked, does that make a difference? Is it as good as the old, more toxic vaccine? And the evidence we have, short-term, it's probably good, but it doesn't have long-term protection. So when we looked at kids who had vaccines 10 years before, it is as if they had never been vaccinated. So 10 to 14-year-olds were as susceptible as kids from 0 to 5. And that tells us it is not the greatest of all vaccines.
So it is the Tdap versus the Dtap? I mean, just to get really, really off in the weeds here.
No, they're both protein vaccines. This would be, the comparison would be whole cell pertussis, which was the whole bacterium, which is no longer in use in the U.S.
So is it, it's an interesting case because when you're thinking about it, people objected to what the old vaccine did. That is no longer out there. They get their exemptions perhaps based on fear of the old vaccine. Is it your position that basically you want to get to 100% with a vaccine that is somewhat less effective as this one appears to be, the current one?
Yeah, I would. And I guess one of the things we're saying, if it wears off more quickly than the old vaccine, then, as we do in the case of measles, which we once thought lasted forever, we vaccinate teenagers against measles for a booster shot. And our suggestion is that we may have to do the same with acellular Tdap.
So you mentioned the availability of data, a bit spotty, and I noticed that the map I'm looking at has Washington, Oregon, Utah, and Arizona. Were these just states that had both data and non-medical exemptions?
That's right. We know there were 19 states that had above average incidence of pertussis, but only five had county-level data that we could study.
And California had some pertussis outbreaks in recent years. I know we talked to health officials there because we do get in, our signals get into California. But was the county level data not available there?
It was. They didn't have a greater than average rate of pertussis, so they weren't objects of our study. They just had an ordinary average rate. What they did have is in 2014 a huge increase in, as you know, measles cases associated with an amusement park in Southern California, and that caused an enormous amount of harm and really raised our concern about the implications of too many exemptions, putting whole communities at risk for a very serious set of childhood diseases.
How have you sort of viewed this? I mean, you got the science mind, obviously, but you're a human being too. And as you see more people getting sick with diseases that were once considered either close to eradication or very near it, what's your thinking of you know what's happened here?
So I think the question that we don't really know, we're good at the science, we're pretty good at the numbers. I think we're pretty good at the vaccines and immunology and testing for safety. What we're not so good at is explaining to parents the value, importance, and risks of vaccines in a way that is persuasive. Part of the California case, for example, which resulted in legislation and a law which now bans non-medical vaccine exemptions after the 600 cases of measles in 2014. The issue is how to explain that to people to understand that not only if their kids are not vaccinated and get sick, they could be a source of transmission to kids in their same classes that may have an immunodeficiency and would be likely, let's say, with childhood leukemia, to die very quickly from any one of these diseases. So that raises the question of what you do with your kid, but also the question, by not protecting your kid, are you putting other children that you may not know about who are at special risk? And that's another issue that we don't understand. And thirdly, pediatricians are very busy in early after birth at the time when moms come in or pops come in for pediatric examinations. There are lots and lots of questions. There's not enough time in many places to explain what the value of vaccines are, what the real risks are, and they're awfully low from the diseases if everybody gets vaccinated, and they're awfully high if you're in a county where very few kids get vaccinated, and then allow parents to make a more rational decision. The third issue is a lot of misinformation. There's a small industry of people who are opposed to vaccines. There was a paper in 1998 that associated vaccines with autism. That study has been recalled. It was fabricated data. It is wrong. It had a total of 12 children in it, some of them playmates of the author. Totally fraudulent scientific paper, retracted from a major journal. Nonetheless, that once you spread doubts about the bad effects of vaccines, it's very hard to make them go away. The National Academy of Sciences, the Institute of Medicine, has run data on millions of children with vaccines, and they have found no association with autism or any of the other claims that were made. Nonetheless, that rumor persists in the internet, and it persists across the kitchen or backyard fence.
Is there, Dr. Bloom, you think, some sort of a middle ground? We've talked to people here who said they do believe in vaccines, but perhaps somewhat later in childhood than we're giving them now, and I wonder what you think of that.
There's not a lot of scientific evidence to indicate that it does anything but make parents feel they're not stressing their kids more. Two things. We, CDC and the pediatricians, have two committees that every year look at the best way to give these vaccines, make recommendations for change depending on the nature of the outbreaks that have occurred and cases in the previous year. And the recommendations for the schedule have been made on the best available data. Many people worry about sticking kids too many times with too many different vaccines in those syringes, and yet the data are carefully evaluated to say kids respond perfectly well to the multiple vaccines. They have been screened so they don't interfere with each other, and they actually save them coming back for more vaccines later. The second point is kids get sick early on in life. By delaying the vaccines, even if they worked, you're putting your kid at risk because they haven't received the proper number of vaccines at the time they're at greatest risk. I remember a time when we had a rule in the states that every child who goes to school in every state has to be vaccinated. But most of these kids get sick when they're going to get sick between 6 months and 2 years. So vaccinating kids only at the age of 7 would leave huge numbers subject to the major childhood diseases. So we've got to get vaccines in earlier into children, and the pediatricians and CDC work hard to get a schedule that is least traumatic for the kids, if not the parents, but also provide the protection as early as they can.
Barry Bloom, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, immunologist at Harvard University, where he's the Joan L. and Julius Jacobson Research Professor of Public Health. He is one of the three authors of Geospatial Analysis of Non-Medical Vaccine Exemptions and Pertussis Outbreaks in the United States, which tracks the overlap of vaccine exemptions and outbreaks of whooping cough or pertussis. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Dr. Bloom, things have changed a bit. I mean, you mentioned some changes. I think the data are generally from 2012, and some of the non-medical exemptions have been removed, yes?
In some states, mm-hmm. And not in others. So one of the striking things is two states have never allowed vaccine exemptions, Mississippi and West Virginia, and they've never had an outbreak of any of the major diseases. So one of the things you have to be honest about in science is because two things are correlated doesn't mean they're causally related. And we have to be very careful to say what we know about vaccines or any other scientific thing and what we know. We know that there's an increased risk in those places that have exemptions. Very hard to prove that any individual child who got sick in those places got it because he or she had an exemption. We work in probabilities, and if you want to protect your kids against rather serious diseases, the statistical data is an awful lot in the favor of giving them childhood vaccines, which aren't 100% protective, never will be 100% protective, and in case of pertussis, it's not the strongest vaccine, but it does reduce what used to be hundreds of thousands of cases to, if widely used, about 1,000 cases. That's a big savings in human suffering, childhood suffering, hospital costs, and cost to parents to take care of sick kids. That seems to me a pretty good deal.
You know, when we talk about the exemption clusters, and I have a map from the study that shows shaded counties, and for us in Oregon, it's pretty much every county west of the Cascades that shows exemption clusters in kindergartners, which means, a percentage above a certain level of people who did not get vaccines?
Yeah. We don't, we know that there are exemptions. We know that the kids that have exemptions are at risk. But they were lucky enough not to be at a place where someone had pertussis and spread it into the community.
Now, there are places where there are two things on the map. We're talking about the exemption clusters in kindergartners, and we're talking about pertussis clusters in children ages 5 years and younger. And there are just a few places where those overlap, where you got the two of them together. But are you saying something about the proximity of the fact that you got pertussis clusters close to the counties where there are exemption clusters?
Yeah, we found that in those places where they both occur, there's the increased risk, which says in those counties outside those clusters, while they didn't have an increased risk of whooping cough, they didn't have an increased number of cases of whooping cough, we would say they would be at increased risk. And parents should know that they would be at increased risk.
Is it pretty much a daily thing in your line of work to have to defend vaccines?
Yeah. I ran a meeting at something called the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the question was, how do people get their information? Why is it that when we provide data or CDC provide data from counties, people don't believe it? And that's a great frustration. We try to present the evidence and assume that when you show the data and the evidence, people will both understand it and act for the best interests of their kids and their families. And what we find is there are people who believe anything done by scientists is suspect, that anything done by the government, and CDC is a government agency, is not to be trusted. Then who is to be trusted? And that's an issue that we've been trying to understand.
All right, an excellent question at that. Barry Bloom is an immunologist at Harvard University and one of the authors of the study in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, about the spatial locations of pertussis clusters and exemption clusters for the vaccine for pertussis. Dr. Bloom, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right.